Welcome to the Gastric Health Show, where we help you achieve the happiest and healthiest version of yourself by motivating you to eat, move, sleep, and think better. The Gastric Health Show. My name is Dawn Boxall, and this week's topic is how to eat for optimal GLP-1 appetite suppression. And this topic came as a recommendation from a patient and follower, and I just thought it was a great idea and how this translates into how you eat. So a few weeks ago, I talked about just naturally increasing your GLP-1 appetite suppression hormone. And they had asked, you know, give me examples. I need examples of what this looks like when I'm eating. So this is what I'm trying to accomplish with this conversation. So hopefully this will help you kind of dial this in a little bit tighter so you have some actionable things that you can accomplish. And when I started writing this, I thought, oh, this is going to be easy. This is going to be quick and simple. And I will say most of my blog posts, and I usually write my podcast content for YouTube. So it's I record the video that I am as I'm recording for my podcast, but it starts out as a writing the blog post. So usually it's about 1,000 words, and this one just kind of kept growing and growing and turned into almost 2,500 words. So anyway, this simple discussion turned into some very exciting and interesting things that I further discovered and additionally found more details on as I was dialing in amounts. So I'm kind of excited to share this because I do think it's very usable content that I think you can truly apply in your life and maybe even evaluate how well you do with it. Because I bet there are many of these things that you are not doing, and they're not hard to do, and they are not crazy foods. They're not crazy things to consider. They're just effective. They're inexpensive. They are easily found at your local grocery stores, and they're tasty. So how can you go wrong with adding these foods consistently in types or food properties to your daily diet? So let's just kind of get started and roll through this. And then I'd love for any of you to reach out with questions or additional ideas or comments on this topic or things you would like to hear about. I would love your input because, again, I think it's fun to explore some of these topics deeper, and the geeky, nerdy side of me really digs into the research, and it's kind of fun to learn new things for myself. So, you know, I might know some things at a high level, but when it gets down to some of the details, I may not know all that information until I start digging. And so, so that's what this information kind of resulted in, some really cool information for you all. So I'm sure as many of you have seen with the explosion of all the GLP medications, many are looking to optimize your appetite suppression. And understandably so, because the GLP-1 appetite suppression medications, although they're not really new, they've just gotten a ton of attention in this last year or so. And they have provided some impressive results for many, many people. And I will tell you, although they probably don't know this or they don't have this information to back up, I would guess the people that this is impacting the most are those with a genetic predisposition to appetite dysregulation. So it shouldn't be surprising in that aspect that the people who are finding life-changing results in the aspect of the brain piece and how it's really transforming the food chatter and just those thoughts of food and planning food and everything around food, and then things that go in that line, how that has really silenced and really quieted those things. My guess is those are the people with those genetic SNPs. So I would love to see this evidence. I would love if I could hook up with somebody who did the research or does research. I would love to do one of these studies and utilize a 3x4 genetic test and really break this down and see the people who have these hungry genes is what we call them. And the differences between appetite regulation and all things that feed into it. So it's not just having those hungry genes, but the ones that are turned on that are experiencing that. And then the other things that control that, like your methylation, which turns on your genetic SNPs or turns on and off genetics. So put all that together. So again, I would love to do this, and maybe sometime I will just have to jump in and do this and just hook up with some doctor that does research and just start this ball rolling. But that's a side note. But I do want to say that not everyone needs appetite suppression. So do not get confused with the messaging. And just because you may need to lose some weight doesn't mean that your appetite needs suppressed. So, and I have seen people who really do not consume too many calories and maybe are not even consuming adequate calories or adequate macronutrients. We'll put it that way. Adequate macronutrients that are getting prescribed these GLP-1 medications. And to me, this is the scary part. Because this is where it's, and this, I guess, is my opinion, is where it's getting misused. They're not asking enough questions. They're not having registered dietitians evaluate the current intake, regardless of how poor someone's food choices are. That's beside the point. So I would say that's kind of one of my beefs with the medication prescription. I feel like it's getting just prescribed, I'll just say misprescribed, because again, I think it's, this is individual and we can agree to disagree, but I think we are disserving the person when we are not educating them on the current foods that they are consuming and how they can shift that and change that to improve their appetite suppression. So to me, that should be step one. And if they've not seen a dietitian and reviewed this and have that education or that knowledge, or even tried it, if they're solely relying on, you know, fast food, then, you know, come on, let's back up. Let's just evaluate their readiness to change and evaluate their willingness to put in the effort. So, and I am all for these GLP-1, GIP, individual combos, medications. I am for these, but I do feel like they are getting misprescribed to individuals that haven't explored other options or tried or even put effort towards that. So I would say that's my one beef with them. But in reality, I think they are going to be a fabulous tool, especially for these people when, you know, as a practitioner, we struggle with satisfaction. We struggle satisfaction in the aspect of the patient feeling satisfied with their hunger cues when we make recommendations. So, you know, I've had patients that they follow all the recommendations, but yet they still struggle with their appetite and they have uncontrollable hunger. So I think, you know, they have those desires that they feel like they're white knuckling, staying away from. So you'll never win when it comes to that. So to me, that those are the individuals who truly need this medication, because their genetics drive a lot of it. Now that doesn't mean, personally, I think there are going to be options that it won't have to be lifelong. One, if you get educated. Two, if you really look at the whole body and really approach it in a different way. It may not have to be forever for some people. Some people, yes. Some people, no. So I'm kind of on a rant here, but let's get back to the topic and the task. But I want you to understand that just because you need to lose weight, don't feel like you have or you're going to need this GLP-1 medication just to be successful. Because even if you don't have appetite issues, that doesn't mean that's the solution to your weight issues. So, appetite suppression can be super helpful when it's out of balance, but it doesn't guarantee long-term weight loss success. And I think you could, if you've had bariatric surgery, you could agree to that, because there is nobody on this earth that has smaller stomachs than bariatric patients. So why is that not solving the problem? So, and then also losing weight doesn't guarantee resolution of your health problems. So, which I did discuss in my recent post and video and podcast on why you shouldn't follow your friend's diet. And in fact, I shared three patient cases of how following a genetically guided diet was more successful in resolving health issues and weight loss compared to a conventional diet. So, to me, I want you to truly evaluate. Are you truly struggling with your appetite, or is it just cravings, or is it just hunger? And if you're unsure of the differences, I covered these topics recently, and you can find them on our website at gastrichealth.com under Does Hunger Mean Your Surgery Is Broken? 5 Ways for Better Appetite Control After Bariatric Surgery, and 5 Tips to Minimize Cravings After Bariatric Surgery. So all of those will give you insight into what you're truly experiencing, because they are very similar but yet different. And here's the thing. I've already dug into, like I said, this how to kind of naturally increase GLP appetite suppression hormones. I've covered that. And I identified the food and food properties that improve appetite suppression by increasing the release of the GLP-1 hormone. So this conversation is just kind of an extension of that, but focusing more on the how and, you know, how you can eat to optimize your GLP-1 appetite suppression. So I do want to preface this for those individuals with genetic predispositions to appetite dysregulation. And although you really may not have a genetic test, you have a strong inclination, you may have a combination of genetics that could be at the root of your appetite imbalances. So maybe you haven't ever had a genetic test done, but you truly do struggle with those appetite issues. And I want you to understand that there may be multiple modalities necessary to achieve ideal appetite suppression, or what you're seeking or needing. It may not only require, you know, optimizing these foods that increase the GLP-1, but it might require medication on top of the foods. So you might have to do both in order for it to work. Additionally, you might have to do some nervous system work. You might need lifestyle changes. You might need neurotransmitter enhancement, which I covered on 6 dopamine boosts for appetite regulation or something in that matter, or any combination of these. So it could be that you need, you know, the foods with the nervous system work or the lifestyle changes and the neurotransmitter enhancements, or you need the medication and the lifestyle changes. I think you see where I'm going. But more of a whole body approach to just achieve optimal appetite suppression. So again, you can't go down one rabbit hole and stay there. And I do think that until these GLP-1 medications have been vetted and have been, you know, we have more information on them, I think, you know, the reality of everyone being able to stay on these lifelong is maybe questionable. One, I think the cost is going to be a deterrent, and hopefully the cost will come down and make them more affordable. But I think the side effects, I think they're, you know, we may not know all the side effects yet or the risks that are involved. So again, I think there may need to be a little more vetting, kind of like I was venting earlier about, I think it's being misprescribed. I don't think there are enough evaluation tools to determine if it's a good fit for someone. So yes, we know that pancreatic cancer, thyroid cancer, those type of things, we know when to rule those out, you know, or the people who wouldn't qualify because of that. But are there other things? Do we know about other things? You know, what happens if somebody has a history of gastroparesis and they are prescribed this? That's an awful thing. So if that is not communicated effectively to the prescriber, they may get this person in a really bad place with gastroparesis. So again, I think we need more tools, more evaluation tools, and not just allowing everyone to be prescribed these GLP-1, or at least I hope not. I just have experience with some prescribers that are truly prescribing to pretty much anyone, which seems crazy to me. So even though I'm all for them, but that's beside the point. But additionally, so it's this conversation is for those people, especially, you know, that if you have those genetic predisposition, you may need more things than just eating these GLP releasing foods. You may need a whole lifestyle approach where you're doing a whole body approach. But this conversation is also for those individuals who just want to optimize the control of your appetite, because there is absolutely nothing wrong with staying full and satisfied with your food choices. In fact, it's actually just smart and how you really should eat, and providing your body with the nourishing foods that can sustain your health and your appetite. Because diet culture has convinced people that you need to be hungry to be successful with weight loss, where in fact, that's just not true. So let's dig into how to eat for optimal GLP-1 appetite suppression. And again, you can watch on my YouTube channel, Gastric Health, and then also our blog under gastrichealth.com. So the naturally increased GLP-1 appetite suppression hormone under those, or the podcast on iTunes. So I explain in that research that I found 4 solid evidence-backed food or food properties that have been found to increase the release of GLP-1. And there are many tested, and there are probably more than just these 4. But for the sake of time, I limited it to these 4 that I found good evidence backing it. And one was yerba mate tea, two was olive oil, three was protein, and four was fermentable fiber. So we will break each of these down into the how and kind of discuss how to make food choices that you can incorporate into your daily life that will maximize appetite suppression. So how to use more yerba mate tea to increase GLP-1. First off, when it comes to yerba mate tea, it can be served hot or cold, does not matter. And even room temperature does not matter. You can add it to smoothies. You can use it as the base of a marinade or a dressing. But they do recommend only using the yerba mate leaves, tea leaves, one time, and avoiding the smoked tea leaves. So it should say unsmoked on the container or bag or wherever you order from. You should be able to find out if it has been smoked. But think of things that you make with a liquid and use the yerba mate tea instead. And of course, you can just drink cups of it. And usually I say just start with one cup each day and determine how you feel with one of those and increase as needed, because you have to take into account there is caffeine in it. So you have to remember that this is a factor for some people. So yerba mate tea is relatively low in caffeine compared to coffee, but some individuals that are genetically slow caffeine metabolizers would want to use caution. Now, one study did recommend up to 3 cups a day. This was for more of cholesterol management or lowering cholesterol, so, which is great, but if you are a slow metabolizer of caffeine, or you have some of the genetic SNPs that influence how you process caffeine, you may not be able to handle 3 cups without it causing symptoms. So one thing to keep in mind is that it takes about 8 hours for caffeine to fully be metabolized in your system. And there are a few gene variations that influence your tolerance. And in small amounts, it can actually provide alertness and enhanced cognitive performance. But however, in higher quantities, it can trigger anxiety, restlessness, irritability, nausea, and insomnia. The opposite of what you want. So even though yerba mate tea can increase GLP-1 appetite suppression, you have to use wisdom in how it's used. In this case, if you don't know your genetics, keeping a caffeine curfew is wise. So if you know that it takes 8 hours for caffeine to be metabolized, that's usually about 2 o'clock in the afternoon curfew to get you in a place that you would be ready for sleep by bedtime. So that's where you're being smart with having a curfew. But most importantly, pay attention to how it makes you feel when you use it. So if you notice increased irritability or anxiousness, you'll want to limit or avoid it. So that's where, you know, yerba mate tea is awesome. And man, the evidence that I found on yerba mate tea was fabulous and kind of mind-blowing in all honesty. And I have it all in that the post on naturally increase the GLP-1 appetite suppression hormone. You can find all the details in there and the links to the studies on all the things that it benefits, because wow, it is pretty impressive. I am drinking yerba mate tea every day. I would say 1 to 2 cups works for me on most days. One day I had 2 cups and it just seemed like too much. And it was just a busy day. So I've learned that I need to taper it. And I actually have, so I'm not a slow metabolizer, so I should be able to tolerate caffeine and go to bed, which sounds fabulous, right? But I have some additional genes that inhibit that from occurring. So for me, I have always experienced jitteriness and more kind of anxiousness with high intakes of caffeine. So I have always been one that I have limited caffeine. And so I really have to watch how much I do. And it's because of those genetic SNPs that even though I metabolize it quickly, so I could utilize it for exercise. So if I wanted a boost in my energy, I could have some caffeine before a workout and it would be utilized quickly. Whereas if you are someone who is a slow metabolizer using it for exercise, you would want to do it a couple hours before your workout, and it will allow you to have enhanced workouts. So, and that's kind of a side note, but in essence, you know, this is something to consider when it comes to caffeine, and yerba mate tea does have caffeine. So the next one is extra virgin olive oil, or how extra virgin olive oil increases GLP-1 release. And this one I will say was pretty cool when I dug into this. I will say that many people get afraid to eat fats. One, because they have a lot of calories, but two, because fats have for quite some time been considered bad for your heart and increase your cardiovascular risks. So everybody's kind of been afraid of, oils and fats and things like that. But I want to show you that extra virgin olive oil is the total opposite in the aspect of cardiovascular risks. It's actually a benefit. And I can show you that. And actually, there were tons of studies on it, which this one, again, I got kind of excited about because I was like, I had no idea the evidence on extra virgin olive oil. And I will tell you, all of them are more recent studies within the last year or 5 years. So they have some really good evidence behind it. So again, I think it's going back to that Mediterranean style diet that they're continuing to find more and more benefits for broad populations, which is why it's so impactful. So recent research has proven that olive oil has cardioprotective effects. And this has been demonstrated by the results of a very recent analysis of two extensive prospective U.S. studies. It showed that an increased intake of olive oil lowers the risk of morbidity and mortality of cardiovascular disease. So it lowers the risks of people dying from heart attacks. Awesome. This was determined after 24 years of follow-up. So this isn't just some 3 month, 6 month study. This has been an ongoing 24-year study. Pretty cool. And they found that the replacement of dairy fat, margarine, butter, or mayonnaise with the equivalent amount of olive oil can significantly lower the risk of cardiovascular disease. And keep that in mind, because as I get to the other properties of that actually increase GLP-1 appetite suppression, dairy comes back in it. And I want you to keep this in mind that you have to have a balance with this. So when they compared it, when you used more olive oil than the fat from dairy, margarine, butter, or mayonnaise, you lowered your risk of heart attacks. Now, what about the nutrigenomic effects of olive oil? What can it do for our genes in actually guiding them to help us? One study recently evaluated the genetic SNP TCF7L2 and documented the role of the traditional Mediterranean diet enriched with extra virgin olive oil in the risk of developing type 2 diabetes, atherosclerosis, and cardiovascular pathologies in subjects carrying this gene, TCF7L2, genetic SNP. And to clarify, this gene is most associated with type 2 diabetes. And what they found was these carriers have a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, especially stroke, when not following a Mediterranean diet enriched with olive oil. So if you have this genetic SNP, and I had to go back to my genetic test, and I have this genetic SNP, and I have this probably in most of my family. We have a huge family history of diabetes, and I have this genetic SNP. And so I will improve, you will improve, anyone would improve your risk factors for cardiovascular disease by following a Mediterranean diet enriched with extra virgin olive oil. So really, this is awesome information, right? So you don't have to be afraid of. And I will say that's probably why I'm not a big pusher of counting calories. Now, I like to see what you eat, so I might ask for food logs, but I'm not a big counter of things. Sometimes I'll have you count fiber or protein, but I'm not big at pushing counting calories. Because what I find is people get freaked out when we need to add more healthy fats, and it takes up so many of their calories. And so then they utilize their calories inappropriately and save them for some, you know, ice cream, Weight Watcher ice cream bar, or something crazy, as opposed to getting the nutrition they need. They utilize these other food properties. So that's where, you know, you have to take your eyes off the numbers and put it on the components of the food that's going to help reduce your risk for disease and enhance your ability for what you're looking for, appetite suppression. So not to mention, several studies show that olive oil provides anti-inflammatory properties. It's rich in antioxidants and polyphenols, and reduces and reverses disease risk. So to me, it seems like a no-brainer to start including extra virgin olive oil on a daily basis. So I'm going to challenge you here now, because I'm going to talk about how much should you consume. So study published in 2022 documented that the consumption of olive oil at exactly between 20 and 30 grams per day was associated with a lower risk of cardiovascular disease and stroke, stating it should be promoted as a means of prevention. Pretty cool. But what about for maximum GLP-1 appetite suppression? What did we find there? Study published in 2015 found that following a Mediterranean diet with 10 grams of extra virgin olive oil daily decreased blood glucose and the DPP-4 activity, LDL-C, OX-LDL, and increased insulin, GLP-1, and GIP. So all of those went in the right direction. So all of, you know, your blood sugar, your insulin, your GLP-1, GIP, all of those went in the right direction, either elevated or lower. And then additionally, a 2017 study found consuming a meal with 10 grams of extra virgin olive oil versus a meal without extra virgin olive oil reduced blood glucose and DPP-4 activity and increased insulin and GLP-1 while decreasing triglycerides and ApoB. All of those are associated with cardiovascular risks. I'm not going into the details of each of those results of hormone levels or, you know, lab indicators that can help you determine your risks for cardiovascular disease or monitoring, you know, labs. So again, it's showing you that 10 grams with extra virgin olive oil reduced all of these compared to without. So just adding 10 grams a meal did this, was a benefit. And then a surprising study found that just buying olive oil was not as effective as extra virgin olive oil. And in fact, it showed that the intake of extra virgin olive oil produced favorable changes in GLP-1 levels, resulting in greater postprandial GLP-1 concentrations when compared with just straight out olive oil and sunflower oil. So it's important to purchase a good extra virgin olive oil, and it really can make or break appetite suppression. And in my opinion, not only do you want extra virgin olive oil, but you should also look for a first cold pressed because this is telling you their extraction process. Are they using chemicals to extract it and then having to heat that product up at high temperatures to burn off the chemicals? And then I look for a harvest date as this also validates the quality. So again, extra virgin olive oil is going to perform better for appetite suppression than just straight out olive oil. So make sure when you're purchasing that you're at least getting the extra virgin olive oil and then preferably a first cold pressed or at least a first or at least a pressed version, which is where they just have rollers on the olives and they're rolling, pressing it out instead of heating it out to extract it. So, I hope that makes sense. Now, I'm sure you're thinking, okay, how much is 10 grams of extra virgin olive oil a day? So, I found that information for you too. 10 grams is about 2 1/4 teaspoons, 20 grams is 4 1/2 teaspoons, and 30 grams is 6 3/4 teaspoons of extra virgin olive oil a day. So, depending on your risk factors, you would at least want to have 10 grams a day, but could go up to 30 grams dependent on your family history. So, I think that is some helpful information, and you can literally drizzle extra virgin olive oil on so many things. And it's easy to make a salad dressing, and easy to, incorporate into your daily foods. One thing about extra virgin olive oil is there is kind of a couple of different camps in this. Some believe that you should not heat extra virgin olive oil as you lose some of the beneficial properties. So here's how I kind of approach it. So if I'm roasting something in the oven, like I roast vegetables or something like that, I try to use avocado oil instead. Then do a light amount. And then after I've cooked it, I might add a drizzle of extra virgin olive oil or find other ways that I can add extra virgin olive oil to a meal in a different way. And if you do have to heat it, so sometimes I've had to heat it as well. Just keep it to 350 degrees Fahrenheit or lower. So just crank the temp down so that you are not exceeding that 350 degrees. And that will at least hopefully optimize if one camp is correct. If it does kind of break down the properties, the beneficial properties by heating it at higher temperatures, then you're at least preventing that as best possible. The next is how to maximize protein for optimal GLP-1 appetite suppression. And really, you shouldn't be surprised by this because it is protein in general is just very satiating and gives you a very full feeling quickly. But I do want to preface this with saying, even if a protein source doesn't increase GLP-1 release that I don't talk about, it's still a viable food to consume. So don't get confused with the messaging and start eliminating good quality protein sources just to increase the foods I'm talking about. And to clarify this further, there was a study in 2018 that documented that the elevation of circulating amino acids, which is what the components of protein are made of, that occurs after a high protein intake is associated with an enhancement of beta cell function and GLP-1 secretion in type 2 diabetics. So all protein is going to help improve appetite suppression. It's just some of these proteins perform a little bit better than others, but that does not mean you should not eat these proteins. To me, all proteins are fair game. So don't get confused. And allergies. If someone has a true IgE allergy, which is different than an IgG sensitivity or intolerance, the protein component is the culprit. When it's an allergy or a sensitivity or intolerance, it's the protein that is causing this issue. So if you have an allergy to any of these foods that I am going to discuss, please do not consume them just to increase your GLP-1 appetite suppression. Please do not have them. Your body cannot tolerate them, so avoid them. So make sure that you consider this if this is something that you struggle with. And again, additionally, dairy, the whey and the casein, is considered a FODMAP, which you can learn more about under some posts I've done before on FODMAPs. I have the link in the blog post and the podcast, and you can contribute to, these FODMAPs can contribute to digestive symptoms for some individuals. So it's important to work with a practitioner like myself who can help you navigate a low FODMAP diet and successfully reintroduce offending foods. So a FODMAP diet is not a lifelong diet, nor is a food sensitivity test something you're supposed to follow for life. So again, work with a skilled practitioner to help you change this. But overall, protein is quite satiating, and studies show that certain ones perform a little bit better than others when it comes to GLP-1. And these include whey protein, egg, codfish, and the casein from dairy. So remember I had mentioned something about dairy earlier? This is where you have to find the right balance, because just because it, one, is one of those properties that it has great benefit with GLP-1, you have to keep it into balance. If you remember the extra virgin olive oil, when we compared it with dairy fats, butter, margarine, so that would be yogurt, that would be, cottage cheese and all of those dairy foods and just straight out milk, you have to keep that in balance, and you can't go eating 12 servings of that a day, just to increase your GLP-1. You're not going to help your cardiovascular risks by doing that. You would want to balance that out with your extra virgin olive oil, where you're doing more extra virgin olive oil and less of the dairy proteins. So, so let's see here. So, of course, when it comes to all of these protein, whey protein, egg, codfish, and casein from dairy, of course, I would want you to consider the whole food sources, which are the eggs, the codfish, and dairy. Not to mention, whey protein is found in cheese, milk, and yogurt. So those are whole real foods. Those, to me, always rank first and should be chosen first. And dairy foods in general have both casein and whey. So you're getting kind of a double whammy when it comes to GLP-1 release. So what should your meals look like? So you can easily build your meal around the protein source. So choose your protein first. And this could be beef, chicken, fish, turkey, pork, lamb, egg, dairy, tofu, quinoa, which is a grain, and amaranth, which is a grain, actually are complete proteins. And then additionally, edamame is also a complete protein, and which means that you have all the complete amino acids that are required for your body to function. But beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, whole grains, and vegetables contain incomplete sources of protein and can be a great addition to any meal, especially when you're combining the complete protein sources with it. So, for example, maybe you're having some chicken with beans as well. That's a great combo because you're going to get all the amino acids that you need. So to optimize GLP-1 appetite suppression, try adding to your foundational protein. For example, if you're having pork for dinner, you could top it with a tzatziki sauce that is made with yogurt. And then add a side of beans and a salad, and make sure the salad is topped with some shredded cheese of course, some vegetables like tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, onions, any things that you like. And then make a quick salad dressing with extra virgin olive oil. And then additionally, some apple cider vinegar, which actually helps your blood sugar, control your blood sugar a little bit better, maybe some salt, pepper, spices, those types of things. And use that on your salad as a salad dressing, because I promise you, there are so few. I can maybe think of one or two companies that actually use extra virgin olive oil as the oil in a bottled salad dressing. And they're expensive. I'm just going to be honest, the ones that use it are expensive. So make your own. It literally takes like 2 minutes to make a salad dressing. So you can easily make that on your own. Now, another example is start with some codfish that's in the air fryer. Then you could drizzle it with the extra virgin olive oil. And then you could have some roasted veggies. And again, top that with some extra virgin olive oil. And then a salad with an extra virgin olive oil dressing can be a great addition with maybe some lentils and other types of vegetables. To kind of help. Or you could even do it with quinoa. You could add quinoa, which would be a great protein source, kind of to put your cod fish on top of, and then have some vegetables with some lentils or beans mixed in, and then drizzle the whole meal with extra virgin olive oil. And that would be a great simple way to optimize your GLP-1 appetite suppression. Overall, I think you are getting the big picture. And but I do want to say an additional consideration, of course, with having a protein shake, with using the whey isolate protein powder. So we talked about whey protein. Well, of course, they make whey isolate protein powders. And I'm all for these, especially in the beginning phases after bariatric surgery, or for those individuals who really struggle with eating three meals a day or just hitting their protein goals. It's an option. But to me, food first. You should really build your day off of the food. And if you physically can't fit the food in, then you go to a liquid whey isolate protein powder to help with GLP-1 appetite suppression. So again, I think it's be smart. Use whole real food first and utilize a protein powder second. That should be kind of your backup plan when you need to. Because in general, liquid protein shakes are going to be less satisfying compared to a chicken breast or a pork chop. Those heavier meats, you're going to have more satiation when it comes to a solid, dense piece of meat. But you could make a protein smoothie, which would help improve that satiation factor. But again, I'm comparing that to a ready-to-drink shake. So the last one is how fermentable fiber can improve GLP-1 appetite suppression. So this is our last food property that can help increase GLP-1 release. And this is an important piece as it influences your gut bacteria, which play a role in appetite regulation too. And fermentable fibers are carbohydrates that contain non-digestible fibers like soluble, insoluble, and resistant starch fibers that your body cannot digest. And studies show that insoluble and resistant starch perform a little bit better because both produce short-chain fatty acids in the colon. And the short-chain fatty acids are what help produce or increase the GLP-1 release. And I did talk about the different fibers in a previous post that you can find the links on our blog post at gastrichealth.com under this topic, how to eat for optimal GLP-1 appetite suppression. But then additionally, this area of research is still growing. So when it comes to the fermentable fibers and GLP-1 release, most of these are animal studies. So far, what we know is that the more fermentable fibers that you consume, the more short-chain fatty acids your body produces, and then the more GLP-1 you release. So again, this is all animal studies, but they have really good evidence. And that doesn't mean, especially when you're coming, when it's in regard to your gut bacteria, sometimes a controlled animal study provides us some really good information because there's so many moving pieces when it comes to the human body that makes us all so different that it's hard to define for sure how it's gonna work in every person. So for some people, some of you may find better results with fermentable fibers than you do some of these other foods for appetite suppression. So, but the big picture is eating more fiber is, you're never going to go wrong. That is always going to help you because it also improves your insulin and glucose levels. So this all ties into appetite regulation. So the key is to consume more soluble and resistant starch fibers on a regular basis. Now, although there isn't a clear number of fiber grams to consistently consume for optimal GLP-1 release, so we don't have those numbers yet, but we know in general that right now the current recommendations are 34 grams for adult males and 28 grams for adult women. So I kind of use the basic 30 grams a day for most people is a great place to be. So, what are some sources of soluble fiber? These include berries, oatmeal, oat and rice cereals, beans, avocado, potato without the skin, pears without the skin, figs, nectarine, peaches, apricots, plums, carrots, apples without the skin, guavas, barley, canned citrus. All of those are great sources of soluble fiber, the ones that have the most evidence for increasing GLP-1 release. And then resistant starch, some examples of those are raw potato, cooked and chilled potato and rice, partially milled grains and seeds, green banana and plantain, beans and lentils. So all of those are great sources of resistant starch. So, and you can see some of them crossed lines and are in the soluble fiber as well. And just because it says the soluble fiber is the potato without the skin, that or the apples or pears without the skin, that doesn't mean you can't eat them. That is just the insoluble part, and that is not the part that actually helps with GLP-1 release or has the best evidence behind the GLP-1 release. So eat the whole apple or eat the whole pear. That is totally fine to do. Now, the benefits of resistant starch have been clearly defined, and this is just for overall health. The current minimum resistant starch recommendation for health benefits in general for all of us is 6 grams of resistant starch per meal, And the average daily American intake is 5 grams per day. So we have lots of work to do. So if you're eating 3 meals a day, you've got some work to do if you're only getting 5 grams per day. So you can see the importance of it when it comes to health. We need this for better health outcomes. Now, unfortunately, there's not been enough human studies that have been conducted to determine the approximate amount of resistant starch required to increase GLP-1. But I personally think that striving for that 6 grams of resistant starch per meal should be beneficial. And this should give you some good benefits when it comes to appetite suppression. So how much is in 6 grams, or how can you get 6 grams at a meal? So here are some examples. A half a cup of lentils is 3.4 grams of resistant starch. A medium banana is 4.7. 1 cup of white beans is 7.4 grams. Uncooked rolled oats is 4.4 grams. Think of overnight oats. Half a cup of potato salad, 4.4 grams, half a cup of kidney beans, 2 grams. So there are plenty of options to consider when you're trying to boost your resistant starch intake. So that gives you plenty of options to add to a meal. So to me, if you start with a protein source and you start adding these properties, you start utilizing the resistant starch, the soluble fiber, the extra virgin olive oil, the yerba mate tea. If you take that protein and you add each of those at each meal, making that a priority, you will see a difference in your appetite. You will find that your appetite will be more suppressed compared to utilizing convenient fast foods, pre-prepared packaged convenient meals. You're not going to get the same GLP-1 release as you will with these whole real foods. So let's wrap this up. I mean, as you can see, for optimal GLP-1 appetite suppression, it is not rocket science. Although there are some intentionality aspects to it, none of these foods are expensive, hard to find, or bad tasting. So the moral of the story is, if you're looking to improve your appetite suppression, write down this list. You want yerba mate tea, extra virgin olive oil, protein foods, soluble and resistant starch fibers. That's it. Focus to those things to get started with optimizing this food piece and see where it takes you. Show yourself what it does for your body before you go jumping into all the other areas. So see how far you can get with this and do, you know, be real with it. Because if you hate some of these things, I'm not asking you to eat these. What I want you to do is find the things on here you like, start incorporating them, and start upping some of the intake of these and see how you feel. Do that for a month and determine what more you need after that. Because in the end, there are endless combinations of meals that you can do with all of these foods I've covered. So you can easily get what you need for appetite suppression with what I've discussed. Now, I would encourage you to, if you are looking for guidance or you need help, you need somebody to put it all together in a nice, neat package, I would encourage you to check out our gastric health membership. This is your best value for services rendered. And our membership would include meal plans, food guides, kind of a whole package of guidance from myself, an experienced registered dietitian with over 25 years of experience in bariatrics and weight loss. So I hope you'll check that out, because that I think would be a great way for you to find what works best for you. So again, there's no magic. It's just, you know, dialing it in based off of your genetics, based off on how food makes you feel, and really, you know, paying attention to the metabolic factors like your glucose and your insulin, and really just focusing on these areas and optimizing them. And that will give you the best results and the best appetite suppression you can ask for. So I hope this has helped, and I hope this really gives you the details that you were looking for in how to eat for optimal GLP-1 appetite suppression. Hope you guys have a great week. See you next time. Bye-bye.